know what we're doing. Anyone enlightened yet? Anyone not enlightened yet? I wanted to talk a bit about perception and the use of perception in kind of contemplative teachings of the Buddha. Kind of coming from that question that was asked about the belief that I'm in the brain or I'm in the body, and then I was suggesting another way of perceiving or interpreting. Perception is, let's say, you see someone that is, let's say you're washing dishes in the kitchen with four people and one person's very slow and inefficient, and your perception is lazy. And then you find out they've got a migraine. And your perception changes, oh, pain. So it's the same person moving the same way, but your interpretation changes. And then as soon as that interpretation changes, the relationship changes, doesn't it? So that's all happening all the time. So perception is the way we, like, it's based on memory, but it's also the way we interpret life. So the kind of contemplative teachings of mindfulness are, like, mindfulness itself is usually in relation to some form of recollection. It's not just functional presence, so you don't break the dishes when you're washing the dishes. There's that part, sure, but there's more than that. There's the whole tradition of contemplative, reflective observation of life. And I think we all do that, otherwise we would not be here. So the recollection of something is not just mindful, but also being present and then recollect, bringing something up into mind. So what I've been suggesting a lot in these two talks and today is to relate to life's experiences through the recollection of change, through the perception of change. And that's not an experience. I'm not saying that you have to have some kind of experience that you notice change. It's more an ongoing interpretation of events as they come and they go. So, for example, let's say that kind of facetious example of some, I said it, let's say you're at a funeral and your cell phone goes off just at the moment when everyone's weeping. You know, and if your personality is very narcissistic, then you answer the phone. So I doubt if we have any candidates for that here. They just say, "Hey Louie, yeah, it's going great." But Bubba, you and I, your average contemplatives, would feel terribly embarrassed. Right? And you'd say, "Oh, why didn't I turn the phone off?" So that's relating to the experience through the perception of self. And that's relevant in terms of morality, in terms of etiquette and just human decency. So you remind yourself, "Mere Dhammo, turn off, I don't have a phone. Turn off your phone," or something like that. And that's okay. That's just decent sort of behavior. But I think we've all seen where that sense of embarrassment or self-consciousness then runs for 2 hours. And we just say, "Why did I do that? I shouldn't be like that." And then it subsides, and then we're having tea, and then the memory comes up again. Memory, ring, 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 ring. Cry, cry, cry. You know, "Oh, why didn't I do that? I shouldn't." That's relating to experience through the perception of self. Okay? So relating to that same experience through the perception of change is a different way of relating to it. And that's, what's the changing nature of this? And the way we do that, we usually use two types of teachings or perceptions. One is the perception of causality. And so I was saying, was it last night, I think, right? That with this as condition, that arises. When there's this, there's that. without this as a condition, that doesn't arise. And there's not this, there's not that. So we call that dependent origination. So you can relate to experience in that way too. So you can see with phone ringing in funeral, there's this terrible feeling of self-consciousness and embarrassment. And if you make that conscious like that and do what's right, do what's socially appropriate, but also relate to that as change, then that's non-grasping, that's non-attachment. Now, the challenge with these things is that because that experience, in this sense, let's say, it is very embarrassing, maybe, if you're not Louis on the phone, and embarrassment is uncomfortable. Embarrassment creates maybe a strong sense of self. It's very hard to be fully conscious to that because your desire mind wants to get away from that. And the way the desire mind operates is, in this case, probably blame. And it's odd about that, where a bit of self-flagellation feels better than actually the feeling of embarrassment. It's so thought avoids the kind of raw feeling. At least that's what I found. So going to that raw feeling, it's like going to the unpleasant, to the discontent, to the uncomfortable in your body. But if you just reside with that, oh, this is a feeling of embarrassment and this is changing, it's causally conditioned. And you don't have to do that much analysis, really. That's just a way of pointing. But it's more very immediate, making conscious. Then that energy goes through consciousness and ceases again. And what you've done is one thing, you haven't proliferated on that and created a lot of suffering for yourself, but also you've encouraged and enhanced and made strong the awareness of change. And the more you do that, the more you do that, the more you do that, that becomes your default mechanism. And the more you notice that, the more you're inclining to the unconditioned. The more you do the other, where you incline towards this constant involvement with thought and emotion and how it should be, the more you move away from freedom, the more you move into just the enslavement of the khandhas. So that's something that is called anicca sanya, perception of change, and it's a kind of mindfulness, isn't it? Now, it's not just thinking, and this is the challenge of contemplative life. The contemplative life isn't just a set of Buddhist beliefs, because then we just become cultural Buddhists. So I believe in Buddhism, or I believe in Darwinism, or I believe, whatever you want to believe in, fine. But actually, as a living practice that actually liberates you and indicates possibilities of freedom, it's a different exercise. So you have to intellectually think, well, that's an interesting way of approaching it. You have to look at it that way too. But then finally, there has to be this life, this kind of liveliness in the contemplative life. So what happens then, you get really good at that. You get more and more skilled at that. That becomes a skill that is more and more prevalent in the way you operate. And any craft, any craft that you do requires time, persistence, application, all those different things. So I was doing some routing on some timber. We're finishing off one of the kutis, and the molding hasn't been done, and I'm doing the skirting boards and so on. So I'm putting in the 4x1s into the router, and bang, it goes all, because I put it in with the wrong grain. The grain was going down rather than up, and so on and so forth. So I need to know grain of wood, I need to know how the router blade works, and that takes time. I ruin a few pieces of wood, and hopefully I don't ruin my fingers. And after a while, it's just second nature. This is grain, this is wood, this is how you put this in. The router, can't figure that out, falls on the floor, break a router blade, cry. And that's very much what the contemplative life is, isn't it? It's a series of errors. One of the lovely ways of describing liberation or enlightenment is the death of a thousand stabs. Ego just dying in little steps. And you see, you kind of lose the plot, you get embarrassed or whatever, and you keep, rather than taking it personally, you keep coming back to seeing the perception of change. But the personal part you honor because that's the social contracts you live in. So it's both, isn't it? So in where you really get strength in this kind of perception of change is in sitting practice. That's where you can really, you're not pressured by things you have to do or whatever. And so the discontents you feel or the old memories that come up, like memory. Memory is very personal, isn't it? Your memories are different than my memories, so that it's not that they're not personal. But then taking them personally and then thinking the storyline personally keeps me embedded in the storyline. But yet I can awaken too and say, oh, memory is this way. With this as condition, memory arises. When this memory arises, there's that kind of a feeling. And I can witness that as change. And that takes faith and trust. Just keep doing it. And it has very, very good results. And that really is the methodology of non-grasping, non-attachment. Again, non-attachment's very, I think it's a very misused concept because it often sounds like you shouldn't be feeling what you're feeling. But you do, you know, feeling arises through causes and conditions. That's the whole thing. When I have the perception that I shouldn't be feeling what I feel, then that's taking it personally. When annoyance arises, I was, again, yesterday I was talking about the difference between annoyance and self-hatred. Or annoyance and any ill will, say. Annoyance just, so someone runs over the septic system, just pay $3,000 for it, the truck's on it. So what do I feel? With this condition, annoyance arises. But is that really me? Am I essentially an annoyed person? You know, is that my true, true nature? No, it's just the situation has arose. It feels that way. If I you know, practice wrong speech and hurt someone, then that's what I have to take personally. But I can also just notice, oh, with this as condition, with a truck on a septic system, and the memory of $3,000, there is this feeling of annoyance. Now, I'm not taking it personally, but I'm still taking personal responsibility for the situation. I still, you know, talk about it and so on. So the flow of consciousness is, it's causally related. And again, what was the aspiration that the Buddha recommended to us is the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed, the unmanufactured. So anything that's caused arises and ceases, that can't be it. And so non-grasping is not rejection. I'm not rejecting annoyance by saying that I should always be cool and equanimous and never have any reactions and 40 years as a monk, you know, I shouldn't be doing that and all that nonsense. No, I'm just saying that annoyance is a force in nature. It arises and ceases. Or it all belongs. It's a beautiful phrase. It all belongs. Morally, no. Don't do that. You can't do that. You don't kill. You don't steal someone. But in terms of stream of consciousness, it all belongs. So annoyance belongs. And then that takes me to the place where the mind begins to see there is something that's uncaused. Consciousness isn't caused, is it? Consciousness is. The annoyance that arises in my mind, that's caused. That's causally related. Well, this is a condition that arises. But do you need a cause for unconsciousness? Maybe you say birth. Okay, you might say birth. That's caused, okay. I don't know. Is consciousness limited by birth? We don't know. But for right now, I know there is presence. Right? There's this discernment going on, but there's not real a... The only way I can get a sense of self out of it is if I think, are these people understanding anything I'm saying? Or am I getting my message across? Or that person didn't smile, or oh, that one's asleep, or I interject things into it. But just the flow of consciousness, flow of events in consciousness, so what is uncaused? What is not causally, what does not arise and cease? To me it seems that presence, or conscious, whatever you want to call it, knowing, awareness. And that we don't notice. It's like not like a, like you have a, let's say if you have a, I was saying in the monastery, you have a book and you have the text of the book, so the printed page, and you're reading it and reading it and reading it. One day you notice, oh, there's the page. Didn't notice the page, I only noticed the storyline, right? The novel or whatever, or the, and then all of a sudden, oh, there's the page. And the page is necessary for the storyline. But the storyline is not necessary for the page. The printed word is not necessary for the page. The page, see what I mean, as a metaphor? So consciousness or awareness or awakeness or presence or... Consciousness is a difficult word. Like in Nepali, consciousness is used in... it's used in the five khanda formulations. You have eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness. And it's also used as unmanifest consciousness. It's another way to talk about it. So the word consciousness is difficult sometimes. And what do you mean by consciousness, and what do I mean by consciousness? So we could get into a kind of argument that way. But there is presence, yeah? I mean, we all know we're here, wherever here is. Even if you're not hearing me, right? And you're thinking about something else, there's still presence. And that's like the page. And then the objects of consciousness are what we call the five khandhas, a body, feelings, emotions, mental structures, sights, sounds, and so on. And they're coming and going, coming and going. And it's like we're so enthralled by them, we never pause to stop to notice the page. Yeah? And then one day maybe one has an experience or something, you're on a lake and your mind just stops. And your mind's still. And then you think, wow. And you're actually noticing the page. But what do you do next? You think of how to buy a piece of land to build a cottage there. And you're gone again. You're gone onto the, you're into the print. Because when desire stops, desire for objects stops. You have freedom. But you think that the desire stopped because you got what you wanted. But actually, desire just stopped. And so the delusion of desire is if I get what I want, then I'll be free from wanting and I won't suffer. And the Buddha's saying, no, just let go of wanting. Just let go of wanting. So I feel, again, go back to the very simple, feel discontent in the body, discomfort, wanting, like the heat this morning. Thank you for the air conditioning. Yeah, I'll take pleasure if I can get it. I'm 67, man. But if it's not there, right, I feel hot, right, that arises. So it would seem that if the air conditioning was always on, I'd always be happy, right? That would seem, that's the only way to happiness, is to keep the air conditioning on. It is one way of comfort. But the deeper kind of happiness, and don't turn it off. There's a deeper happiness where, and the peace, like this morning, really, it was like there was the restlessness with the heat, and just heat feels this way. Notice the desire, the uncomfortableness, and it ceases. And then I think, well, why was I peaceful? Not because the temperature was changed, but because the desire ceased. And when the desire ceases, what happens when the desire ceases? You're no longer enthralled with the print. You're not looking for peace in the print. You're back in the white page. Huh? Print's still there, but you're no longer. That's no. You're no longer dependent on the print for excitement or peace or whatever. Huh? See what I mean? It's important because this is a teaching which is about a profound liberation. Certainly, like I'm a better person, I'm a nice guy and all that for doing this, but it's more than that. That's just kind of a nice side effect. And even if you're not a nicer person, that's all right, as long as you don't kill anyone, right? So if you're a grump, you're a grump, that's all right. But the important thing is this not the changing of personality, is that if our personality characteristics keep us enthralled with the khandhas, that's the problem. So if I'm a very hyper-judgmental, critical, judgmental kind of person, and everything I see, oh, that's not good, that's not good, that's not good, that's not good, it's a terrible way to live one's life. But also, more deeply, it's looking in the wrong place. You're not available. One isn't available. to that, the transcendent, or whatever you want to call it, to peace. So then it's not just a matter of being goody-good and some kind of unreal, smarmy sort of personality characteristic you're looking for. You're saying, no, that's not fruitful. And then you have a real willingness to let go of that way of operating, not because you feel guilty about it, because you just realize it's not where I want to look. So you get the happiness of letting go of these unskillful habits, but more deeply you become available to the page, as it were, to the white page. Yeah, so perceptions then, as you find in our monastic training, there's a lot of training around that. So like we have contentment with little. That's an idea, and you could say it's an ideal. But as a contemplative perception and training, the way it works practically, say so we have a standard of alms food. These are the necessities of life: alms food, roof over the head for the night, clothing to cover the body, and just medicine. So those are what we call the four requisites, and those are necessary for living. And I certainly saw this in Thailand, and the standard is to be content with little rather than want a lot. Now, when I got to Thailand, those early years, way back, I certainly wasn't content with little. My mind had been conditioned to get what I wanted, and I wasn't, I wasn't grossly indulgent, just moderately indulgent, normally indulgent, I suppose. But certainly if I wanted something, I would just get it, buy it, go to the fridge, or whatever, just normally, even bored, play some music. So then I'm in a monastery, and now all those options are not there, and it's one meal a day. And the reflection is every day, patisankha yoniso pinyapatam patiseva, when we chant this, wisely reflecting as you use alms food, not for fun, not for pleasure, and like that. So we have a kind of recitation. And then I look at my food, and the first thing my mind says, oh no. Sticky rice and dead fish again, So that's my conditioned mind. The mind which could have what it wanted. That's the conditioned mind. But then the reflection is, it's good enough to take you through to the next day. And that becomes a mirror. Now, if it was an ideal, then I'd feel guilty about wanting different food. And if I believed wanting to fruit, I would have disrobed. The diet's not good. but just the contentment with a little, then I could see how dependent I was on my happiness for certain types of food. And I could see the discontent or the complaining, and I'd get these incredible childish jealousies if someone got a bigger mango than me. It's so terrible. This guy next to you's got a bigger banana than you, and you're like, well, he got two bananas, I only got one. And you see this kind of child kind of coming up in you, and it's not self. You relate it to it through the perception of change. So you have this kind of reflective skills, I suppose, that reflective skills that content with little. And then what happens over the years is you keep repeating that and noticing discontent. Oh, discontent feels this way. Then relate to the discontent through the perception of change. And it does change. And because it's not fueled with thought and with belief and so on, then more and more what arises is gratitude. There's gratitude. Oh, these people have fed me today. Fantastic. Really, quite spontaneously. Now, if you would have said to me, Viridhammo, you should be grateful and content. These people are hardworking rice pharmacists. They don't have much money. They're giving you the very, very best. If you laid that trip on me, I could feel guilty, right? And hate myself, or I would tell you to drop dead or whatever. But it wouldn't have worked. And that's idealism. That's attachment to idealism. But reflection on a perception on something which is skillful, which leads to the end of suffering, is different. And so content with little is a very important reflection, santuti in the Pali, because you can see, if I'm content with little, then I won't be preoccupied with getting more. And if I'm not preoccupied with getting more, enough for my family and so on, but if I'm not preoccupied with getting more and getting the upgrade and getting the bigger and all of that, then I'm available. I'm available to the page rather than being lost in the print. Huh? So it's very practical. It's very practical that way. It's not, and so it's not like an attachment to some kind of idealized renunciant lifestyle where you can't buy things or have fun or whatever. Not that at all. Sense restraint is one of the strong perceptions we're encouraged to develop in Indriya Sangwara. And sense restraint is obviously, I live a celibate life, there's no music, and there's not much distraction and so on. But just the mind always going out to objects. I was just going out to thought all the time, or fantasy. And sense restraint is like staying home in the heart, rather than going out all the time, out into ideas or situations. And it becomes a very beautiful way to calm the mind. Now, if I took it ideally, I think, well, I shouldn't look at anything, or I shouldn't experience any joy or something like that. That would be silly. But I see the skill of sense restraint. So really, in a city, I can see if we're very skillful. If I'm getting confused in a city, I just focus down. We probably all do that. Just look at the concrete. Don't get distracted. Stay centered. And then if I'm not scattered, then I look at the architecture or whatever. I find it interesting. But there's a real skill in sense restraint. So I suppose now the place of sense restraint is the internet. In terms of just the amount of time one spends in front of those screens. And that's a very, very, you can do Buddhist YouTube things till the cows come home. But it's a lot more difficult to meditate for half an hour, isn't it? You get a fascinating talk on some interesting subject by a really charismatic monk or teacher or whatever, and then you want another one. So not to deny that. So the contemplative life is not a technique. In a meditation we have techniques and so on, but contemplative life is something that we're doing all the time. And we're understanding ourselves, we're exploring our minds, and then we're beginning to apply these contemplative principles, reflections, to bring us back to awareness of change, and then that opens the doorways. That is the doorway, that is the goal in some sense. Any questions for anyone around that or other things? Yes?
I'm presuming you don't mean the same thing when you use the term awareness and consciousness.
I use it synonymously.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's a difficult word because it's used in different ways and it's used in different cultures in different ways. Presence, awareness, being, consciousness. You see what I'm pointing to, huh? Page as opposed to the print, yeah.
But Ajahn, isn't consciousness itself subject to changes?
Well, like I said, in the suttas, you have the five khanda formulation, that vijnana is the fifth of the khandas, eye, consciousness, nose. But also you have anidasana vijnana, which is unmanifest consciousness. And that's not talked about so much. Or you have in the six elements formulation, you have consciousness. So the danger is here is trying to figure it out with thought, right? So the way I do it is I think, well, there is presence. Well, first of all, is there a goal? Is there the unconditioned, the uncreated, unoriginated form? Is there that, right? So now I'm coming from faith. Buddha says there is that. If there were not that, there'd be no freedom from the form. Okay. So that's very important. I'm not just coming from Western science or my own ideas of consciousness. I'm coming from the texts or from my teachers. And I think, okay, so what the heck's that about? Unconditioned, uncreated, unformed. The Dhamma is ahipasiko. It's imminent. Akaliko, timeless. Come and see for yourself, right? And what's all that about? Timeless. Openaiko, inward. Inward. And you start to get all that language as a kind of contemplative operation going on. And you begin to see, well, it can't be just sight. So I see you, and that changes, right? But in the experience of sight consciousness, I always have the sense of presence. It's always there. I'm never absent. Or there's always a sense of presence. And that's what I begin to question. Not as an idea, because I can't figure it out through thought. But I intuit that sense of presence and try to turn towards that rather than try to go to thought. And the thought can't figure this out. This is where thought has its limitations. Where thought takes me is more like via negativa. Not this, not this, not this, not that. That's via negativa, right? But the Buddha wasn't just like there's a nothingness. He says there's the uncreated, unoriginated, unformed. So I begin to practice non-attachment. And I notice that awareness or consciousness or presence, it's always there. And so what is unchanging? You know, the mind begins to contemplate in that way. What is it that does not arise and does not cease? Now, if it wasn't some form of consciousness, you couldn't, you know, if it's not connected to consciousness in some way, what's the bridge or whatever? So I can give you, I don't have the reference right now, I'll give you the reference for that other way, the Anidasana. Vijnana, the other way of talking about that, Pabhasara Jitta and so on. So there's another language. So mostly you see the five khandhas formulations. But, you know, beyond the texts, in your own experience, is what was the Buddha talking about something, right? And what is it? And if it's a matter of time, it can't be a matter of time because time is birth and death. So it can't be tomorrow, right? It cannot be tomorrow. And you begin to see, well, time is something that arises and ceases in the present moment. Chronological time or diary time, right, or calendar time is certainly, I do have a dental appointment on the 30th, right, and I better make it, and so on and so forth. But then it arises and ceases in the present. And you can never know the future. You can only know thoughts of the future, thoughts of the past. So you begin to even question time. Not intellectually, but existentially, experientially. And so akaliko, it's not a matter of time. The Dhamma is not a matter of time. And you see myself searching for something. And that can't be it, and that's desire. No, it can't be desire. So you let go of desire. And you just come back to the present moment all the time and let go. And each time you try to figure something out, oh, that's thought, that's doubt, and you let go, letting go, letting go, letting go. And I think that's all you can do, I think. Right? That's all you can do. So these words are maybe clumsy, consciousness or awareness or presence, but they're pointing to something, pointing to something, and that ineffable sense of presence is what we don't notice because we're caught with the objects. So when you start to do perception of change, start to abide as that rather than being enthralled by the things which do change. And desire is that which is always trying to find, you know, the kind of right combination or whatever. It's always looking to change things or find something. So does that kind of, it's an intuitive process rather than just a structured linear intellectual process for me. It comes from a sense of emptiness in my teachers, Lompo Cha, Lompo Sumedho, from the texts, there's the unconditioned, the uncreated, my own experiences. And its basis is renunciation, really. Giving up the distractions and the fascination with the world, and yet enjoying the world. That's the beauty of it, you know. The more you do this, the more the beauty of the world is the beauty of the world. There is this mudita in the heart, gladness, because you don't really need it. That's the kind of magic of it. And we've all had that. You do a retreat, right? And you get the mind a bit quiet, and you notice a daffodil. And you go, woo-woo, or whatever. And what is that? And that's gladness, because the heart's not consumed with its own narcissistic tendencies or whatever, right? And then then you want to grow it, and you start thinking again. All right, yeah. Anything else? Yes?
I'm wrestling today with, and maybe we can talk about this, the difference between feeling your feelings and being mindful, and the difference between mindful and kind of disconnection or dissociation. And
okay.
So I think those things can...
If my observation of an emotion is just a kind of intellectual noting, then I don't think I'd be fully conscious of it. If I was fully conscious of it, there is a kind of openness where it arises in all its discomforts, say if it's negative, all its physical energies, and it arises unhindered, unquestioned, in a way which allows it to kind of fully be present in the mind. And what would be unskillful in me would be a kind of avoidance with it by judging it or analyzing it or distracting into something else. So my references would be around simple things. First of all, what does it feel like to be fully aware of sound? You know, I use simple things like that. And then simple things like, what does it feel like to be fully conscious of discomfort? And it's very visceral, it's very real, it's very alive. And then that insight or that intuition then would more and more automatically be the way I relate to more difficult emotional feelings and so on. So it's a kind of a sense of rightness, I think, in the whole attitude that's going on there, which comes from the simple to the complex. So if you have a question, is this disassociation or not? What you can do is know that you have doubt, right? And quite often the problem is not the feeling, it's the doubt. Am I doing this right? And so am I really practicing the breath right? Should I do it here, there? And actually it's not the breath, it's doubt. I want to be sure. And if you make doubt fully conscious, you see it doesn't really matter. Rather than having a guarantee that you're doing it right, allow doubt to become fully conscious. I don't know. Am I doing it right? I don't know if I'm doing it right. And allow that to be just as it is. Then it'll work its way out. When one allows awareness to be fully present to the way things are, what is functioning is discernment. Wisdom is functioning if you allow it to function. It's like, I was watching the wild turkey and its young one walk along my meditation path the other morning. It wasn't meditating. It was eating. And I'd never seen a wild turkey eating. Fascinating. So I got my binoculars out and I just watched and watched and watched. And I noticed, turkeys eat raspberries. Why not, right? Yum, yum, yum. And they're very good at it and very quick. So I had an insight into turkey behavior. Not because I was looking for insights into turkey behavior, but because I was open to observing the way things are. And it's the very same with the mind. It's like you have turkey behavior inside. And if you just have the patience to allow the unfolding of events, discernment's always functioning, wisdom's always there, and you get connections, you see how it works. And that's the natural process of insight. We use this word vipassana in Buddhism. It's a kind of strange word because it's actually not that much in the texts and it's used as a kind of technique. But actually, if you think about it, how does insight work? Insight works when I observe. I observe a child, I watch the child's behavior and I say, I kind of understand, don't I? Yeah? The same way with your own mind. So when doubts come up, then you can use that doubt to say, okay, am I disassociating? Then make the emotion stronger if you want, and play around with it and so on. Go right to it. But quite often the predicament is the doubt itself. And we don't see doubt as an object, we become the subject. Make some sense there? Something to work with? Yeah?
Yeah, and if I can just say one more thing.
Sure.
I found myself kind of just collapsing into surrendering, I would say, into grief.
Okay.
Gaza earlier, and then the doubt was, you know, and I was aware of the tears and the snot and everything else, but I guess the doubt was, is that surrender to pure emotion part of the path, you know, the stuff?
So the question for me would be, where is indulgence and where is surrender? Okay? And perhaps the issue is around sense restraint. If I go to horrible imagery, then that horrible imagery is going to bring up all response in me, right? And if I refrain from going to that horrible imagery too much, that so much of that response won't be there. Now, sometimes horrible imagery, I have no choice. I'm culturally involved, I'm familiarly involved, you know, I'm very close to it, so it's very close to me. But lots of times I do have a choice in the sense, well, yeah, I know it's bad, but how much of that do I need to bring into my consciousness? If I need to be socially engaged and socially active in those issues, then I need to do that. But you can imagine, if I take on all the horrors that go on in the world, boy, it's a rough ride. And I am an emotional being, I'm sensitive, I feel all of that. So I would say that if you are, you know, if you go to issues which are close to heart and you stimulate them, they will cause strong emotional reactions, right? And you have to bear with them. So, say if I have strong, if there are strong issues going on in my community, I have to engage in them. You know, I can't just walk away from them, and they have powerful impacts on me, and I have to process those. But there's a lot of things I don't need to pick up, so I don't need to pick up Gaza and Israel because it's not close to me. Right? It's horrible, certainly. We were once doing metta bhavana on a retreat at Amaravati in England, and there was the bombing of Baghdad, not Baghdad, but of in Yugoslavia, bombing of Belgrade. And I was suggesting a metta practice to people, and they were doing compassion to various types of people, and two women were crying. So I went to them, I said, what's up, what's going on? One was Yugoslavian, and she was thinking of her relatives in Belgrade and spreading metta to them. But what she was doing was that she was worrying about them all the time. So rather than, you know, spreading metta to them, she was kind of trying to heal them in some kind of way and getting more and more distraught and bringing that up into her mind, which I thought, well, is that really helpful for you or anyone else? The second woman was, I think she was Burma. She was doing the same thing. She was thinking of all the suffering going on in Belgrade. And just in tears. So, how do we do this? Do we pick up all of it? No. We pick up some of it, yeah, because we are engaged and we are responsible in some kinds of ways. But also, you need to protect the heart, especially in the work we do. You know, we are, you know, we're good people, and we do care about the planet and so on and so forth, and. Sense restraint has its place there, which isn't like ignoring these issues, but seeing the limits of our own heart to deal with them. And then if they are like, you know, these kind of strong feelings of suffering going on, then we also try to develop equanimity. And that's the hard one to develop. You know, in the teachings on the heart, we have what we call the four Brahma Viharas. The first one is goodwill, which we call metta. The second is compassion. The third is gladness. And the fourth is equanimity. Equanimity is very, very hard. Huh? Goodwill is sometimes it's translated as loving kindness, but it's just that general intention not to harm anyone that we can do. Now, compassion is feeling for the suffering of others. But if compassion is not balanced with equanimity, it leads to depression or you know, extreme forms of sadness. When equanimity doesn't have compassion in it, or joy, it becomes very, very sterile. So the Buddha saw that our heart responds to life according to context in various ways, and he said there are extremes. So gladness, so like for me, mudita, this word mudita, like flowers bring gladness. When someone is like understands something that I said, I'm glad. Or a child gives me a drawing of something, you know, that is done. It's so very proud of it. It's a drawing. Isn't it? It like brings a lot of gladness. Too much gladness makes you too excited. Yeah, too excited. Compassion can be very useful, but we all know, you know, most of us are in kind of caring situations. It leads to burnout. So what is compassion and equanimity? How can I develop that? And each of us has to work that one out ourselves. So for me, if my compassion is leading to being more and more distraught, I kind of try to regroup and say, well, wait a minute, what's skillful here? How can I be at peace with the way things are and yet also be compassionate in my life? So I tend to just say, well, what I can operate locally, and that's where I can really exercise real compassion, where it's useful. And on a global scale, it's too big. And it's just too big for me. And to take it on in a kind of... Having said that, my parents are from Latvia. When there's a Latvian tennis star, I'm all for him. There's this guy called Gulbis, who's a Latvian tennis star. So I am affected that way. And being with these friends yesterday, and they're afraid that Russia will do a Ukrainian number sort of on Latvia or whatever it is. And I feel that. I feel that because it's part of my karma in that way. There is, you know, the world is tragic. It's a tragic place, yeah. Great tragedy. That's why it's very important to be, you know, to practice forgiveness. Tragedy is part of our predicament. And there's something maturing in accepting that, I think. Something maturing. And then there's roses too. There's both, yeah. Any other things for anyone? Oh, great. We've covered it.